Let's get started right now. On Friday, the Supreme Court issued a ruling that upheld a federal law that prohibited people who are subject to domestic violence restraining orders from having firearms, and that particular rule does not violate the Second Amendment. With us to discuss this very important, not only is it a gun rights case, but it's a domestic violence decision, is Dr. Bernadette Myler. She is a law professor at Stanford. I have to tell you her qualifications. She's Harvard educated undergraduate, received her law degree from Stanford, and a PhD from University of California. She's the author of several books, including Theaters of Pardoning, and I have to add, this is a fun fact, she's also a classic violinist trained at Juilliard. Welcome to the show, Dr. Myler. How are you?
Very good. Thank you so much for having me today.
I think like this, you know, I was reading this resume to my husband and he said, oh, she made that up. It's very, 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 very respect. I have a lot of respect for your education. Let's talk about this decision. I have to say I'm very happy about this decision as a person who practices in the domestic violence field. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about the facts of the case and what the U.S. Supreme Court had to decide here?
Absolutely. So what made this case difficult and complicated are not the facts, which were pretty egregious. So basically, the person who was convicted and or who was being prevented from having a gun under this federal statute had not only a history of domestic violence, but also a history of violence generally, was suspected in a variety of shootings. So the facts are pretty bad for him. But he was mounting a facial challenge against this law, saying it couldn't be valid in any circumstances, based on the Supreme Court's decisions a few years ago about a New York statute that prevented people from getting guns without licenses, so without prior proof of various facts in order to get a license. And so in that case, the Supreme Court had laid out a very exacting historical standard for whether the federal government or states could regulate guns. And they said that there had to be some kind of analogous statute or law from the past that would be similar enough to the law in question that the law in question could be upheld if it was burdening someone's right to bear arms, especially having handguns. Now, here, the question was whether this law is impermissibly burdening the defendant's right to have handguns, where he meets right to have a handgun in violation of the Second Amendment. And so the way that the Supreme Court had laid out this standard seems to be very historically based, and there aren't domestic violence restraining orders from the past that could be direct analogies to what was at issue in this case. So that was why the case was difficult. It wasn't because of the facts of the case, which really demonstrated that this person shouldn't have a gun at all.
Let me interject. So just to kind of repeat what you said, which is interesting. So this recent court, in order to determine, you know, whether something's constitutional, you look back into the 1790s and you say, hey, was there a domestic violence, you know, exception for the Second Amendment or something similar or analogous? And if there isn't, then this current law cannot be upheld. And so let's just take a deviation from that for 1 minute. So, you know, I think of the Constitution and how it's really lasted, and it's, you know, and it's been called a living and breathing document, which means that it has to change with the times. Does it make sense for you that the court, I mean, you're a scholar in this area, does it make sense for the court to go back and really have to find something analogous? And why I say that is because we certainly didn't have the internet in the 1700s, and we certainly didn't have all kinds of other things back then, but the court gets to decide things based upon current and more modern events and standards.
Absolutely. And I think that in particular, in this case, it doesn't make sense to require a historical analog. And let me explain why. So I think that in some varieties of originalism, which is what the court says it's practicing in this kind of case, the court looks at the original meaning of a right to determine the scope of the right and, you know, what might be covered. But I think the precedent in the Second Amendment has gone even further than that by saying, look, government can't act unless there's a historical analogy for their action. And now, of course, there might be new circumstances that come up in which government would want to act, or in the domestic violence area, for example, we might realize how much this area is problematic in a way that we didn't realize before when women couldn't vote for laws. So, or at least, you know, more people would realize it. I think that by requiring an analogy of prior government action to validate current government action, that is really imposing the court's judgment way too much in the political process. And I think that one of the interesting things about this set of opinions, which are many opinions, actually, but all except one reaching the same general conclusion, all of them say, oh, there has to be judicial restraint. The Supreme Court is really like an umpire. It's not intervening in policy. But actually, this Second Amendment doctrine is really intervening a lot in policy because it's striking down a lot of governmental regulation that would have been permissible before.
You're listening to the Karen Conti Show. I'm talking to Dr. Burnette Myler. She's a professor at Stanford. We're going to finish up with talking about this case and what it might mean going forward. And then I want to talk a little bit about what's on the docket and what cases might be coming up as soon as maybe next week. You're listening to WGN. Welcome back. We're talking about the U.S. Supreme Court decision that came down. I just want to give you some facts about domestic violence and firearms. Abusers with firearms are more than five times more likely to kill their female victims. Every month, an average of 70 women are shot and killed by an intimate partner. And this is fascinating. Nearly 1 million women alive today have reported being shot or shot at by intimate partners. So this is a serious, very serious issue in our society. And with when it combines with firearms, it's even more serious. And I think that this decision, I'm very relieved that the decision came down as it was, which the court said it is okay to take away firearms from domestic violence perpetrators. We're here with Dr. Burnette Myler, who is a scholar at Stanford, and she's talking a little bit about these. So, Dr. Myler, I'm looking at this Hunter Biden issue. So he was recently convicted of lying on a firearm application about his addiction to drugs. And there's been talk that that particular law might be subject to a constitutional challenge. How does this case that just came down with the domestic violence issue affect that potential challenge, if it does?
Yes, I think it actually makes his case a bit more difficult because what the court did here was to say, look, the analogies don't have to be as direct with prior laws as we had previously maybe suggested, and it can be just that the principles are the same. And even in the Rahimi case, the court talks a few times about statutes involving the prohibition of intoxicated people or drunk people having firearms. And so if we think that, you know, in the past there was a prohibition against people who are having firearms, maybe an analogy is people who've taken drugs. Now, I think there's one distinction, though, with Hunter Biden case, which is that in his case, he had, you know, falsely stated on the form that he hadn't taken drugs recently. But there hadn't been a kind of individualized proof that he was under the influence of drugs or anything like that before this prohibition would have taken effect. And that's quite contrary to the Rahimi case where there was an individualized hearing. And the court made a lot of the fact that there's a very individualized basis for decision making for the domestic violence restraining order. So that is a big distinction, I think, from the Hunter Biden case. So even though I think this case makes it more difficult for him to constitutionally challenge his conviction, I think that there's still room to distinguish the decision that just came down.
Does the court get to consider, and the statistic I see is it varies, but somewhere between 35 and 50 million Americans have reported some substance abuse issues in the past year. Does it matter that so many Americans have substance abuse issues and that if that law were to be applied, you know, that would take the Second Amendment rights away from quite a few people? Does the court consider that?
The originalist justices generally say that they will not consider the impact of a law, that they're considering really just the original meaning and how that should be applied in the present. But I think that in the background, of course, they're going to be considering that fact, and especially given the opioid epidemic and all sorts of other, drug use among Americans, perhaps really applying the statute broadly would mean that many, many people couldn't have firearms. So they may be concerned about that, and that could influence the decision in the Biden case.
Interesting. Well, we'll keep an eye out for that one, because I'm sure that will be going up to the Supreme Court. One pending case that will likely be decided soon, I believe, is one that involves the question of whether a U.S. president has immunity from being prosecuted for crimes committed while in office. I'm sure you listened to the arguments or read about the arguments before the Supreme Court. What do you think the court is thinking about? How are they going to decide this? And when do you think this decision might be handed down?
Yes, well, I think one of the hallmarks of this case has been that it has been subject to a lot of delay. So I think one of the most significant questions is going to be just when they actually will hand the case down. I'm not sure about that, and there has been already a lot of delay. In terms of the substantive issues involved, there's really never been a precedent for this because there hasn't been an effort to try a president criminally for acts that they committed in office. So there have been efforts to establish immunity from civil trials for acts done in an official capacity, and that's a somewhat different circumstance here. There's arguably, or the government is arguing, that there's a much stronger interest in prosecuting a president who had committed crimes because there's a very strong public interest in preventing that from recurring and preventing presidents from acting in that way. But the main arguments that Trump is making are that he would have to have been successfully removed from office through impeachment before a criminal prosecution could occur, and also that it violates his rights as president, violates the separation of powers for a court to be considering a prosecution of the president for acts committed while in office. Now, I think the Supreme Court, I would guess that it's more likely to side with the D.C. Circuit, that it would want to see this broad a sense of presidential immunity from crimes committed while in office. But the question of how that applies to Trump himself may be, a vexed one, and they may want to defer the decision as long as possible.
Interesting. So, I mean, is it possible, anything's possible, but is it possible that our Supreme Court could say that a president can do anything in office? I mean, literally kill his opponent, literally, commit murder on the street and he would be immune. You're hearing people say that to the illogical extreme here. Is it possible the Supreme Court could decide that and under what would be the ruling and the reasoning?
I don't think they'll decide something like that. I mean, the most plausible, I think, argument, if they were to go with an immunity argument, would be to say, well, if Congress had a chance to impeach and failed to remove the person from office, then that suggests that the underlying events weren't sufficiently egregious to warrant a criminal prosecution, maybe. So that might be one avenue where then they would say, well, of course, if he murdered his opponent, then he would have been convicted by the Senate. But
we don't know that. I mean, it's exactly. Impeachment is a very political decision. It has nothing to do with really much of anything other than the vote, the vote to do it.
Yes, absolutely. My feeling is that probably they will not say that there is any form of absolute immunity from criminal prosecution for acts committed in office. So I don't think they will go that far.
We only have a minute, and I want to just get this really quickly. We talked about this on my show before. There's an issue regarding homelessness that is with the court and should be ruled upon briefly. And the question is, essentially, can a municipality criminalize homelessness in certain circumstances? And without getting into the idea of whether that's socially a good thing to do or not, what do you think the court's going to do here, Dr. Myler?
I think they're going to say that the city ordinances can stand because I think that they're going to be concerned that both Democratic and Republican policymakers have said that doing the opposite and saying that it's an Eighth Amendment violation to prohibit encampments, is going to really restrain what cities can do in terms of their policymaking. So I think that they're going to, you know, uphold the ordinance.
And so the governments can punish people, actually throw people in jail for being homeless under certain circumstances.
I think so, yeah.
And whether the municipality chooses to do that is going to be an issue that's, I'm sure, going to be jurisdiction to jurisdiction, with certain cities wanting to do that and certain cities not finding that something that would be palatable, I would imagine.
Exactly.
Thank you so much for joining us. Dr. Bernadette Myler, tell me just briefly about your book, Theaters of Pardoning. What is that about?
Oh, well, that's actually about 17th century drama and politics, and looking at the way in which the pardon power is connected with questions of sovereignty. But actually, I've written somewhat about how that played out in the first Trump presidency, because Trump's use of the pardon power was very reminiscent of King James I, a king in the early 17th century in England.
Oh my gosh, that seems like deep reading. Maybe not a beach read, but maybe in the fall. Thank you so much for all of your wisdom, Dr. Bernadette Myler. Thank you so much for joining us here on WGN. Have a good one.
Thank you.